Good morning. My name is Frank Dravis, and you are listening to WDRT Conversations, 91.9 FM in Viroqua. Today, my guests are Kristen Zummo from the Audubon Society and Craig Thompson, co-founder of Driftless Birds. Hello, Kristen.
Hey, Frank.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Excellent. Thank you. Craig, how about you?
Good morning, Frank. Very happy to be here.
So, today, middle of February, I woke up this morning, let the dog out to go take her pee, and it was 44 degrees. Now it's over 50, and it's going to be nice and sunny. I mean, spring is definitely in the air. I heard some species, I don't know what they were, chirping in the background. So we get to talk about spring birding, which I'm really excited about. I love birding. I'm very much a novice. I can tell you what the common species are, and I can tell you my favorite songbird is a white-throated sparrow, and that's about the only song or call that I remember or recognize. So that's the kind of birder you're talking to. But anyways, Kristen, let's start with you. What is the Audubon Society?
Yeah, so the National Audubon Society is a nonprofit conservation organization. Our mission is to protect birds and the places that they need here for today and for tomorrow. We believe as that birds are these powerful indicators of our planet's health, and they act as, you know, the canaries in the coal mine, you know, pun intended. And because they're just these conspicuous, both in their presence and especially in their absence. And so at Audubon, we believe what is good for the birds is good for us. So we work collaboratively for science-based and community-driven impacts.
So when you say national, what do you mean by national?
So that's the interesting thing. So national is technically in our title, but we actually work on a hemispheric approach. So even though we are the National Audubon Society, and yes, we are, you know, based and incorporated here in the United States, we actually have about just under 900 staff and 1.9 million supporters spread throughout 11 countries that are in the Western Hemisphere. So everything from Canada, the U.S., Mexico. We hit the North, Central, and South America.
So Audubon Society would have a hemispheric perception or measurement of what's going on in the world as far as birding and species.
And we really kind of have to, because the majority of the birds that we have here in the U.S., they actually spend at least part of their time somewhere else. So they are not, I think it's upwards of like 99% of birds spend at least some part of their annual life cycle outside of the United States.
Well, we're going to get to talk about that. So what do you do at the Audubon?
So I am a range ecologist, and I work through Audubon's Conservation Ranching Program, which is our premier grassland habitat program. Most birders are going to be familiar with, you know, the 2019 report that came out from Cornell stating that we had lost about 53% of birds in North America since 1970. And of all of those, grassland birds were on the steepest decline. And that's because their habitat's on the steepest decline. So Audubon developed this conservation ranching as a non-traditional market-based approach that turns consumers into conservationists by being able to select the beef and bison that's in our stores that has the Audubon Conservation Ranching label on it. And so as the range ecologist, my job is working with those grazing landowners to come up with habitat management plan and goals for their property that utilize the movement of their cattle in a way that actually like reflects how bison used to move across the landscape.
So thank you very much for that. You are assigned to the Driftless region, is that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So me, when I think about range, I think about out west,
yes,
South Dakota, western Minnesota, etc. And Craig, we are going to get into the types of ecosystems or terrain or topography here in the Driftless that hold the different birds. Is there a lot of range in say, and let's put a very fine point on it, because our listeners for WT, even though they are national, they can dial in and they can stream it, live stream it, or even download the recording, which they do a lot. The live listeners are in Viroqua, or, well, Vernon County, Monroe County, Crawford County, maybe Richland County, in parts of La Crosse County. So in that area, mm-hmm. is there very much, quote unquote, range?
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting. When we work with landowners here, we actually more often use the term farming or farmers.
Okay.
They actually prefer farm to ranch because we do have grazing lands in this area.
Of course.
But they're obviously a lot different. They're a lot smaller. And so that's, you know, diving into the details a little bit, but
yeah,
still 10,000-foot view.
We have lots of pasture and land that's in CRP and lying fallow, et cetera.
Yeah, and so we actually, with the Conservation Ranching Program, part of that program is regional protocols that match the grazing of that region. So, like, the Driftless area has its own set of protocols that matches how grazing landowners are doing things here, which is recognizing that it's very different from how they're doing things out west.
Excellent. So I remember hearing about the Audubon Society when I was growing up as a kid. So how old is it?
We actually celebrated our 120th anniversary last year.
Wow.
And the Christmas bird count is a little bit older, which is 125 years.
So I've participated in the Christmas bird count. Mm-hmm. The local icon that I had the honor of sitting in the car with, going from bird feeder to bird feeder, a couple of days before Christmas or whenever it was Fred Lesher from UWL. Oh,
yes.
You know, birders in the Driftless area will recognize his name. And so, yeah, I had the honor of, you know, actually sitting with him and learning from him, you know, about the different species that we were seeing. So in the spirit of full disclosure, Kristen, you and I first met a couple of years ago when you were at Mississippi Valley Conservancy, and I believe you were doing some sort of wildlife inventory for us,
mm-hmm.
and we were trooping around, and who was with us? There was,
I believe it depends on, I think Abby might have been with us, who is their conservation director, and then the second time was Connor, who is their, I think his title's changed now, but stewardship associate at the time.
And I just remember you two gushing.
Yes.
I mean, literally, Craig, they were gushing over finding two different flowers that they hadn't seen in a while or had never seen. And then you guys had Merlin out and you said, oh, there's a blah, 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 blah. Do you know what that blah, 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 blah was?
Yes. I think Connor and I, on the tail end of our bird survey, we found a magnolia warbler, which is, you know, it's a migratory bird through the area. It doesn't really generally nest here. So it was a really cool kind of spot for us at that time of year. We got very excited. It was on the way back down, headed back towards your house, and we were just like, oh, there it is. And, you know, we all get very excited and flushed when we see something, especially the first of the year birds. So,
I was duly impressed that you guys were impressed, and I was just a little disappointed that I didn't actually know what it was, right? But okay, so that was cool. So, Craig, you, I gather you were at the, you worked at the DNR for a long time, is that right?
I did. So my bio says that I started working in DNR when gas was 96 cents a gallon, which is actually true. I just completed a 38-year run with them, so I retired last year. I was very fortunate in that most of the time I spent with DNR, I was able to work on bird conservation in various forms, and by the time I was winding down my career, I had a strong international component responsibility associated with my job. So I actually got to work with international partners. Kristen had mentioned earlier that a very high percentage of North America's birds actually winter in Latin America. And what that means then is that when we are talking about conservation strategies for these what are considered to be long-distance migrants, we have to have strategies that span entire hemispheres. And it makes it incredibly challenging.
Because you have different governments you have to work with.
Well, different governments, different nonprofits, lots of turnover in terms of partners. You have to get the resources that somehow can address not only breeding ground needs, but wintering ground needs. And in response to an emerging aspect of bird conservation science, there are also stopover habitat needs. And what I mean by that is these birds make these miraculous journeys, but on occasion they have to stop and rest and refuel as they're traveling thousands of miles to Colombia or Brazil or even Paraguay in some instances. And so those areas where they stop are called stopover sites, and it's incredibly important that those sites, those that are particularly important for their survival, are protected and managed appropriately.
So I'm jumping ahead a little bit. How many different flyways or migratory pathways are there through, I'm not going to say North America, but through the Driftless, through the region we live in? How many are there?
It's just one.
And it is called the what?
The Mississippi River Flyway.
So is the Mississippi Flyway, is that section of it that's just south of La Crosse around there, is that a stopover area?
Well, let's put it this way, Frank. The Driftless area is the largest block of forest between boreal Canada and the big deciduous forest of the Ozarks.
Okay.
And so just by the very nature of its presence and its expanse, it's about 24,000 square miles. There are millions of birds that pass through this area twice during spring and fall migration, many of which will stop here to rest and refuel. So to that extent, yeah, it's an important stopover site. Stopover ecology gets into the real nitty-gritty of, are these birds, when these birds are stopped at these sites, are they actually putting weight on?
Oh, okay.
And it turns out that fat on a bird is the currency of migration. It's like filling your car with gas.
Uh-huh.
They have to have fat and body fat in order to make these unbelievable journeys. And so the real discerning factor as it relates to whether a stopover site is important, and that's a vital distinction, is whether birds are actually spending multiple days at a site and gaining weight while there.
Okay, so we'll talk a little bit more about that, but now I want to expand my question. I had narrowed it to the Driftless, but now I want to, want to expand it to North America. I have heard that the Missouri River, through South Dakota, I had heard that that's a flyway, is that right? Or a migratory pathway?
Not on its own. It's part of kind of like that Mississippi.
So it's all part of one.
Yeah.
Okay. Have there recently been shifts in which ways the birds like to go because of drought or climate change or anything? Across the continent, have they been shifting, moving left or right, west or east at all?
I don't know fully the detail of going into that kind of depth, but I do know, they're usually very specific to their flyway. Some birds might cross over and such, but in some instances, there are total populations that are, for sandhill cranes, for example, there's a population of sandhills that are very strictly central flyway, and then there's a population that are very strictly Mississippi River flyway. So I don't know. Outside of that, I'm not totally sure if they've been shifting. I don't know if Craig has any more.
Well, okay.
It's a good question.
Yeah.
And I'm not aware that birds are actually shifting flyways. What we're seeing in regard to climate change is birds are beginning to shift as it relates to some birds overwintering where they never used to. Mm-hmm. So sandhill cranes, it's entirely possible, for instance, that sandhill cranes, which breed in Wisconsin, will become winter residents in the not-too-distant future.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
The winters are becoming that mild. Migration is such a hazardous endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
Man, they encounter every imaginable hazard. This is all birds, whether big or small, power lines, wind turbines, windows, outdoor cats, and so on.
Well, so some of these subjects I didn't know we were going to touch, but now I do. But before we go there, it's been said that you have a clinical obsession with neotropicals.
Well, okay, so yeah.
What is a neotropical?
Well, as Kristen alluded to, we all get a little goofy about birds when you live in the bird world, and it's a reflection of our passion for being able to work with birds. It's a joy and a privilege. I have had the opportunity to spend a lot of time in Latin America, and what I can tell you is that let me put it this way, there are about 240 species of birds that breed in Wisconsin, okay? By the time you get down to Colombia, which is about the size of Texas, you have 1,900 some species of birds. Mm-hmm. And so as you get closer to the equator, the bird diversity ramps, the sheer number of birds that are located in areas ramps up significantly. And so if you like birds and you head to the tropics, the bird watching is literally off the chart. Mm-hmm. It's intoxicating. Wow. And so that's kind of where I am, Frank, is it's really fun to bird here in Wisconsin. I love it, but there's nothing, for my money, there's nothing better than going to Costa Rica, Panama, Peru, wherever the case may be, down in Latin America, to see the incredible profusion of birds at every turn. There's just new stuff everywhere all the time.
Now, I read somewhere that one of your favorite species is the yellow-billed cuckoo, and you actually see it here in the Driftless. And so I Googled it, right? And I took it. You might think of it just because of the name, is it's a really colorful, you know, like parrot type bird with the toucan type beak. But the beak on a yellow-billed cuckoo, as soon as I saw it, that told me it was a flycatcher. Is that right?
No, they're cuckoos. Yep.
They're cuckoos. What is a cuckoo?
Well, So if we look at all 11,000 species of birds across the planet, each one of them falls into a particular category. And cuckoos are very taxonomically distinct. So,
Do they eat flies?
No.
They don't?
No. They eat primarily caterpillars.
Oh.
Yeah. And that long, decurved bill that they have is ideally adapted for them. It predisposes them to hopping through dense foliage and finding caterpillars and grabbing them and swallowing them.
So that's kind of where I wanted to steer the conversation for just a little bit, was the features of the bird, mm-hmm. like that curved beak, mm-hmm. identify that bird as being of a certain type, that it feeds or it behaves a certain way because of these different features. And this curved beak, as you just said, was uniquely adapts the bird for foraging on a certain type of mm-hmm. prey or food.
Yes, but so it kind of gets into the arcane world of taxonomy and classification of critters, and there are a number of features that are used to determine what bird falls into what category. Bill morphology, the shape of the bill being one of those, mm-hmm. but they look at skeletons, feathers, phylogenetic origins, you know, what else might it be related to? How did it evolve? So there are a whole host of factors that contribute to enable taxonomists to say this bird is a wood warbler, this bird is a thrush, this bird is a hummingbird, and so on.
So I, as the novice birder, when I'm out, you know, on a birding hike and I'm with a bunch of other birders, they'll call out the types of different, the tail, whether it's, you know, V-shaped or whether it's flat across the bottom. Can you, when you see the shadow of a bird hanging in a tree, maybe you can't see the beak, but are there nuances you can pick out about the bird when you see its tail, and you can make any, are there any sort of generalizations from the different tail types when you see them hanging in the trees?
If I'm looking at something that's specifically a shadow, that might be a little bit more difficult. But yeah, I mean, I have a tendency to look at things like tail length or how they're, you know, carrying themselves, if they're sitting upright or if they're a little bit more like hunched over and flat, or the bill is another thing. Also, like where they hang out in the canopy can mm-hmm. also tell a lot. There are certain species that just like to be much lower, and certain ones that are, you know, we all talk about warbler neck, because warblers have a tendency to like to be up in the really high canopy, so you're always like leaning your neck backwards, and so by the time you're done birding that day, your neck is stiff. But so there's a lot of things that kind of go into what we use as identifiers. And honestly, for me, a lot of the times I'm using their audio, their songs, to really pick it up first. But
so I know birders generally all have their own lifetime.
Our life lists.
Their life list. And sad to say, I lost my life list in my 20s. I don't know where I put it, and I haven't restarted it, but I did have one at one time. We'll start out with Kristen. What are, when you're walking through the driftless prairies or woods, what are the one, two, or three birds that just thrills you when you see them? And I don't care the time of year.
Yeah, I think I'm a warbler nerd, I'll say that. I really love the warbler species because they're just all so bright and colorful and have so much going on. For me, I always get very excited when I see a Blackburnian warbler, mostly because it's one of those species that stays really, really high. So you often hear them, but you don't see them because they don't come down low enough. So when you get a view, it's just like, oh, it's so exciting. On the total opposite end of the spectrum, when I hear or get to see ruffed grouse in the area, which are a declining species. We don't have a lot of them kind of hanging out here. But I loved hearing and seeing them. And on occasion, I'll have a year where I'm hearing or seeing more than in other years, which is typical for that type of bird. But
let me do a channel check. Good morning to our listeners. My name is Frank Dravis. You are listening to WDRT Conversations, 91.9 FM in Viroqua. Today, my guests are Karen Zummo from the Audubon Society and Craig Thompson, co-founder of Driftless Birds. You know, we were talking about grouse. That is a favorite subject of mine. I'm a bird hunter. Sustainable, you know, bird hunting. Two types of species of birds that I like to hunt are grouse and pheasant. And truthfully, even though both of them taste good, the reason why I love grouse hunting is I love hunting with my partner. My partner generally is a 90-pound Labrador, and, you know, flushing and retrieving, and it's the bond between birder or hunter and dog, or in this case, partner. And, you know, it's grouse hunting and pheasant hunting, and this is when I get out in the field, and your success grouse hunting and pheasant hunting is completely dependent on how well you've worked with your partner and such. Now, we used to have grouse on our property along the Mississippi River, but, you know, 30 years ago, that was when the trees, and I know just enough about grouse to be dangerous, by the way, and, you know, just enough to hunt them, that we had a lot of quaking aspen, popple, as you, other people might call it, and it was, you know, they were 20, 30, 40 feet tall, maybe that tall. And the grouse would sit up in the trees and they would eat the buds. And it was just fascinating watching them. Well, now we no longer have grouse on our property because the forest has aged. It is no longer emergent. And so we now have mature oak and walnut. And the quaking aspen that we have are really tall. They're dying out, and I don't have grouse anymore. And it was it's kind of sad, but, you know, forests age, right?
We don't have the same amount of disturbance that we used to have in terms of, you know, allowing storms to do their thing, whether they knock trees over or fire comes through or whatever. We've kind of, as a culture, suppressed a lot of that. So what used to come through in terms of storms and fires and such and kind of reset the forest back to that early successional period, it doesn't happen quite as much anymore. So, yeah, we get a lot of our forests are aging and getting to that mature stage, and we're losing that earlier stage. And the birds that rely on that obviously kind of go along with it, the grouse being one of them.
So, Craig, you know, as the spring birding season's coming up here and you're walking through the driftless, what are the one or two species that you look forward to seeing or just thrill you when you see them?
Well, I share Christian's passion for warblers, for one, but there are other species as well. I have to say, Frank, my favorite is the scarlet tanager, which is just this stunning blaze red bird with jet black wings that spends the winter in the west slope of the Andes in South America.
My wife will just go on and on when she sees a scarlet tanager.
That's literally a bird that, birder or not, whenever someone sees them, it's an oh my gosh moment. They are stunning. And the females are very much the opposite. So they're olive green with black wings by design. But when I hear or see that, it's just a knockout. And of course, another one of those long distance migrants. And I'm happy to see anything that comes back from South America or Central America, just because it's nothing short of miraculous that these tiny birds can travel thousands of miles twice a year. I've been doing this for a long time, and I'm still in awe of those little birds when they return.
Well, one thing I want to make sure or point out to our listeners is, there may be quite a few non-birding listeners, is oftentimes the male of the species is very colorful, and the female is drab. And a lot of times when the two are sitting side by side on the same perch, you may not think they're the same species just because the coloration is so different. Why is that?
That really has to do with, from the female's perspective, she's looking at the flashy colors of the male. It means he's, you know, usually with reds and stuff, it means they've got good diet, they've got good genetics, they're healthy. And that's like his way of like showing off a bit. But the female is usually more of a drab color to protect her while she's on the nest. So if she was that bright, brilliant red sitting on a nest in a tree, she'd be very obvious to predators. So a lot of the females have a tendency to have more drab colors, whether it's browns or streaks or just something that kind of hides them and camouflages them a bit better.
We talk about this arduous migration. How do hummingbirds do it? Now, the hummingbird that's sitting on my feeder in Stoddard, in September, Craig, where is it going to go?
When that bird migrates, it's going to end up somewhere in Central America. So birds have a breeding range in North America, the species we're talking about. The ruby-throated hummingbird that you're referring to, Frank, in the winter, almost all of them, go down to Central America to spend the winter. So they get from southern Mexico all the way through far western Panama. And they occupy early successional habitats. We were talking about the lack of aspen, and Kristen had mentioned that the forests here are becoming older. They don't want to be in old forests. They want to be in young forests and open habitats because there are a lot of flowers and a lot of insects associated with those bright, sunny environments. And so that's where they spend the winter. And then every year they come back up. Now, when they go south, some of them will cross the Gulf of Mexico. If you can think of a little bird that weighs like a tenth of an ounce, about as much as a dime, and its little wings are beating at 50 to 53 beats per second, how that bird can cross the Gulf of Mexico, 500 miles of open water. And once they're aloft, once they leave the Gulf shore of Alabama or Mississippi or Texas and they're airborne, they're committed. They have to keep flying. So in order to do that, they double their body weight before they actually take off. And by the time they land on the Yucatan Peninsula or south of that in Latin America, they've lost at least half of their body weight, maybe more. And sometimes the flights are so strenuous, if they hit a headwind or if they have to navigate a storm, many birds won't make it. This is literally the most hazardous time of any bird's annual cycle. So all the things they do throughout the year, migration is the most stressful. But if they land, they may actually be metabolizing their own muscle mass. They become that dependent on the energy reserves that they have in order to survive. And when they land, they have to feed right away in order to make it. And that speaks to this need to have sites that are suitable for birds that are making these arduous migrations. Therefore, you know, this stopover ecology, where do birds land, are all the resources that they need, becomes critically important in terms of maintaining this hemispheric phenomena that we refer to as migration.
That's incredible that hummingbird can make that journey. I mean, you hear folklore, you know, about how they're hitching rides on the back of geese, and that can't be.
You mean that's not true? If Frank, I had heard
it. It would be very nice if it was true, and it would make a lot of sense. But, oh boy.
I heard the most amazing statistics. So when these birds, any of these birds, and many of the species, including the wood warblers that Kristen had referred to, are crossing the Gulf of Mexico sometimes twice a year, sometimes just once, sometimes they take land routes on the way back. They're aloft for 18 to 24 hours nonstop. These, again, it's just, how can they do it? Imagine doing jumping jacks for 12 hours straight. That's not even close to the amount of physiological stress that these birds are experiencing. I did hear an amazing statistic. Somebody that was really smart and had a sharp pencil penciled it out, and they said, look, if birds burned gasoline as efficiently as they burn body fat, if our cars burn gasoline as efficiently as birds burn body fat, our cars would get about 450,000 miles to the gallon. They're that well adapted to do these journeys.
That's fascinating. That's incredible. So I mentioned, middle of February. Is the spring birding season, is the spring migration, has it started already?
Probably not quite. We might start seeing some of the ducks and some other early earth migrants towards the tail end of the month. So we're starting to get into when ducks and some of those guys will start coming back. March is when we'll start seeing more of like the blackbirds and some phoebes and some other groups of those types of birds. But for me, like with the warblers, they're April. They start in April and really peak. Everybody peaks in like May. So we're getting close, and we're all going to start getting excited with this 50-degree weather out here.
So for our listeners who are, have their bird feeders outside their kitchen windows and are waiting to see new activity, it's probably maybe a month off, maybe a month and a half off yet before they see what I call the errants come through.
Yeah, probably a little ways off. Right now, you're going to still be seeing a lot of the winter birds here, so like our juncos and some stuff like that. I think when I start seeing the juncos start switching off with the chipping sparrows, I'm like, oh, we're starting to see that flip from our winter to our spring birds moving through.
Okay, because the juncos, they nest here year-round.
They're a little bit more north of us. Yeah, they're a little bit more north. But they come down from the north here and they winter here. So they're they're tiny little sparrow sized birds, but they're all gray with like a white belly. So everybody will see them. They're very popular at bird feeders this time of year for sure.
Right. So are there species that have recently tended to stay here and have not moved farther south?
We're seeing that in an intermittent way with some species. It just depends. So again, if birds don't have to migrate, they won't. So as our winters become more mild, we'll probably see some species that would go to the southern United States that will begin to winter here. On occasion, I see white-throated sparrows, one of your favorites, Frank, that literally spend the winter here, not in large numbers, but that may change over time if this becomes a more suitable habitat for them. Normally, they go to the southern United States. We have species like Carolina wrens, which is a lovely southern, in quotes, wren that is that's expanding its range northward as winters become more mild. So as winters become more mild, they're more able to survive and they have more young, and so the population begins to build. If we have a really severe winter, a couple of weeks ago, it was wicked cold for about 2 weeks. That's enough cold to actually cause mortality in some of those birds that aren't quite hardy enough to make it through those really cold bottlenecks. Like, I wouldn't doubt that there was some loss of Carolina wrens and perhaps some other species that were trying to winter here, but on balance, we're trending warmer, and so we'll start to see more birds that are spending the winter over time.
All right, so it's minus 19 out. It's like 1 o'clock in the morning. How are the birds staying alive when it's that cold and say windy and blowing? How do they do it?
They really have to hunker down, but I mean, their feathers are kind of like a key warming system for them. So that's why when birds are really warm or trying to regulate their body, or cold and they're trying to regulate their body temperature, you see them like they fluff up and they're suddenly everybody, what are they, the the social media version of calling them burbs or borbs or whatever the funny things when you see them all fluffy and big.
So they're trapping
air underneath their feathers to keep themselves warm, basically.
Are there places that they try and hide and get out of the wind, or that are maybe potentially warmer or more hospitable when it's that cold?
Yeah, actually, I mean, they find whatever, you know, bushes and shrubs and stuff that they can hunker down into. But I've also heard of some of them, if there's bird boxes and such around, there'll be birds just kind of hiding on in there at times. So they try to find as hidden away a spot as they possibly can. But sometimes, I mean, the negative 40s and stuff we had recently with the wind chills and everything, I believe I heard of or read about some of the bald eagles being found over in the Genoa area, maybe, that they were all just, they hadn't passed on, but they were frozen. Like, they were unable to move and had to be taken in and rehabilitated in order to be let go because it's just too cold at a certain point. Mm. And I think that one, it was also because the temperatures had dropped so fast that they couldn't readjust themselves appropriately in time. Mm.
And what we see, to continue that thread, what we see with a lot of the smaller species is communal roosts at night. So chickadees will clump up basically into a ball of chickadees to try to share body heat and to save body heat. And the same with nuthatches. Some of the woodpeckers may roost in pairs. And certainly some other things like bluebirds. You might find five or six bluebirds in a nest box, to Kristen's point, that they find these microclimates that are a little warmer and they try to use them. There was someone who did, Frank, a study on kinglets, which are these little songbirds, little bitty songbirds. They're actually a tad smaller than a chickadee. There are two species. One is called a golden-crowned kinglet. The other is called a ruby-crowned kinglet. Normally they winter in the southern United States, but on occasion we can find them here in the winter. And someone was looking at kinglets that were wintering out east, and what they said is these birds were eating primarily spider eggs. That's it. They don't eat anything but insect matter. These little kinglets are not seed eaters. And they looked at the physiology of the bird, and they said these birds are probably finding just enough food every day to make it through that night. And the next day they have to find the same amount of food to make it through the next night, and so on and so forth for weeks at a stretch until the weather breaks. So there's probably pretty high mortality associated with some of these species that aren't seed eaters in the winter simply because it just gets too cold.
Mm-hmm. Kind of reminds me of the hackberry trees in Riverside Park in La Crosse. People would oftentimes remark, "Hey, I saw a robin in the middle of wintertime. What's the robins doing here?" And I gather it was the preponderance of hackberry trees and the berries on the tree that were holding the population of robins localized in and around that area and around Riverside Park. So I suppose the specialized food source will help them in their survival, as I gather.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And hackberry is a wonderful wildlife tree simply because, as you pointed out, their fruit is persistent. And what that means is that the fruit is really hard and it stays on the tree all winter. Mm-hmm. Some of the fruits with the dogwoods and the viburnums, while valuable, are not persistent. They drop by the end of summer or early fall. But hackberries provide this really important source of winter food for a whole bunch of species. I've seen pileated woodpeckers, red-bellied woodpeckers, and so on, eating hackberry fruit in the winter when there just isn't a lot else around. And to your point, Frank, you find these big flocks of robins. They're just hammering the hackberries while they're down here. Same with starlings. And it's probably a situation that enables them to persist, because without those hackberries, they are either going to perish or they're going to have to move on to find some other food source.
Yes.
So hackberry, great tree.
Sumacs are another one that hold their seeds all winter long, so you'll see them hitting on the sumacs when it's really cold as well.
So in the driftless area, what are the predominant types of ecosystems or habitats that, as we get ready for the spring birding season, we may want to consider going to? What kind of habitats do we have here in the driftless?
Yeah, so I mean, as Craig mentioned earlier, the driftless area is like the largest tract of interior forest from between the boreal forest and the Ozarks down in Missouri area. So we have a lot of that kind of interior forest habitat here. So we have a lot of those, the birds that hang out there. But the other cool part is that we are not just within the Mississippi Flyway, but we are right on the Mississippi River. So we have a lot of these really great wetland complex kind of habitats as well. So we're kind of really lucky in this area that we get the kind of like the best of many worlds in terms of where we can go birding. So like the Coulee Region Audubon chapter, I think in May during the height of migration, they actually host like two different birding hikes.
Hang on a second. Let me talk about that in a second. Yeah. I need to do a channel check.
Oh, yeah.
Good morning to my listeners. If you've tuned into us, my name is Frank Dravis and you are listening to WDRT Conversations, 91.9 FM in Viroqua. Today, my guests are Kristen Zummo from the Audubon Society and Craig Thompson, co-founder of Driftless Birds. So we were talking about habitat. Craig, Kristen, as people think about going on birding hikes coming up here in a month and a half or so, where are some of the best places for them to go? Lookouts, hikes, you know, in and around Vernon, La Crosse, Crawford, Monroe counties. Where would you recommend them going?
Yeah, so being based out of La Crosse, I tend to stay around there quite a lot. It's just easy. I love walking through the marsh trails that are in La Crosse. There's tons of stuff that comes through there. Not just waterfowl and other birds, but tons of the warblers start hopping in through there. You could also go up to Hicks and Forest, which has a lot of those interior birds. And then I also go up to Holman area, the Seven Bridges, I believe, the Van Loon area. That's a kind of like a floodplain forest kind of habitat that gets you a whole different variety of birds than just like an interior forest versus, you know, marshland. We're really kind of spoiled here in this area in terms of what we can go and see. Spreading out from there, I know a lot of the Coulee Experimental Forest is a really popular place to go as well. New Amsterdam Grasslands has a lot of grassland birds. It's probably one of the larger tracts of contiguous grassland in our area. So there's a lot. I mean, I don't know if Craig has his favorites too.
All good spots that you mentioned, Kristen. I love all of them. I would only add two more, which is the first is Trempealeau National Wildlife Refuge, which is a spectacular oak barren sand prairie site that kind of juts out into the Mississippi River. It's a migrant trap. You find all kinds of great birds. They're both marsh birds and land birds. During spring migration, it's a real hot spot. And the other, which is I think the mecca of bird watching in Wisconsin, and that's Wyalusing State Park, down on the confluence of the Wisconsin River and the Mississippi River. It is at times literally the best spot, I think, in the Driftless area to see species. All kinds of them, and just great looks. It is a wonderful place to visit.
So the out in front of our place on the Mississippi River, there's a marsh, and I love it when the pelicans come through. I just love watching them. You know, I guess it's a rookery when they're all nesting up and they're all together in this big white mass, and you hear them honking, and you occasionally see them catch a fish. There's a bigger bird, believe it or not, than the pelican. It's just as white. It comes through. Is that a snow geese or a tundra swan?
If it's bigger, it's one of the swans. We actually get tundra and trumpeter swans that come through the area.
So the reason why I'm hazy as to which one of those it is because normally at night is when I hear them most. And it's for like two nights in the fall, two nights in the spring, and it's just about that short a period of time where they are just honking like crazy, and it is loud. It's a ruckus. Does that give you any clue as to what kind of bird that might be?
I would still lean more towards the swans. They're much, like, especially when you look at them, if you see them flying, like, the wingspan on them is much more comparable to the pelicans than, say, a snow geese would be.
And do they come through in the thousands?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. We are definitely a hot spot. People plan a whole bunch of different types of just like swan trips here, both in the spring and in November is kind of like their peak migration coming back through.
So what are some of the other species that people may flock here to witness or watch?
Good one, Frank. Yeah. there are all kinds. As we've been discussing this morning, this is just a bird hotspot. And because we're literally on the river, at least in La Crosse and Trempealeau and so on, you can see anything. We have high numbers of bald eagles, incredible numbers of waterfowl that Kristen had mentioned earlier are going to be showing up within the next several weeks. Tens of thousands of tundra swans, thousands of pelicans, literally millions of warblers, flycatchers, and so on are going to be passing through in the upland habitats. You can't go wrong in spring and fall for migration here in the Driftless area. We really are blessed with an abundance of birds and a diversity of birds.
Now, when you talk about upland, I've written some articles on birds, and in one of my articles, I had to differentiate between a red-bellied woodpecker and a red-headed woodpecker. And I want to go into this because it gets to the type of environment or habitat that the two frequented. And while they're both woodpeckers, and they both kind of look the same, I mean, it's easy for me to, mistake a red-bellied woodpecker for a red-headed or vice versa.
We have you on tape now, Frank.
Yes.
What's the habitat differences between those two species?
Well, so, I mean, for me, the red-bellied is a little bit more on the ubiquitous. It's more common of a woodpecker. It's not as picky. I hear them in town as much as I hear them in the forest. So they're a little bit more easy to spot. But the red-headed is what we kind of call a specialist. They have a very particular kind of habitat. They're much more mature forest, but like open. So like think oak savanna or the oak woodlands where the understory is kind of cleared out and it's spacious in there, but it's a mature forest, which is something that's it's sometimes can be hard to come by. So they're much pickier about where you're going to find them. And they're actually, because they're in this interface between forested and kind of grassland habitat because they like the savannas. We actually, for our conservation ranching program, even though they're not a specific grassland bird per se, we've included it as one of our focal species because it is in this interface that's just as important as some of the other grassland habitats here.
And the reason why I point this out is because there'll be people who will go out and they'll say, well, I didn't see such and such. Well, it could very well be that you weren't in the right habitat.
Yes.
Because I can tell you that when I go through my forest or woods, I don't see very many, if any, red-headeds, mm-hmm. but I see a lot of red-bellied.
Yes.
And it's just because I think it has to do with the maturity and the density of my forest. It's just not open enough mm-hmm. to attract the red-headed, which, you know, it is what it is, right? So as people start thinking about, you know, signing up for bird hikes and such, what are some of the things they should think about bringing with them? I mean, we know binoculars are important.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone should probably have their own set of binoculars and know how to use them, right?
Yeah.
Merlin is getting to be, or maybe it already has been, a very popular app. Can you explain what Merlin is and...
Yeah, Merlin is fantastic. Anytime I'm out with landowners and people who are interested in birds, I'm talking this app up. But it's an app that was put out by Cornell. It is kind of like it's a digital field guide in a sense, but it has this extra capacity not just to look at the picture of the birds, but you can turn it on and have it record and listen to what's going on around you. And it will pick up all of the birds that it is hearing and list them out for you with their pictures. And then it also, as it's continuing to record, if it hears that bird again, it will highlight it on that list so you can tie it back to what's being heard in the field. So it's a really great resource for people who aren't very familiar with that bird identification to be able to see what's and hear what's actually on their land or wherever they're birding.
Is there any apps or tools that you use, Craig?
Merlin is the best tool out there, period. And I use it on occasion. I learned birdsong the old-fashioned way just from people who knew it.
I was going to say the experts. The
audiobooks.
The experts probably are no longer using apps, but anyways.
Yeah, so, you know, and it's just so fun to listen to birds because by the time, and I know Kristen has experienced this as well, but when we do bird surveys in late May to early June to understand where birds are breeding and how many and what their distribution is, we're just basically listening for species. And so when we walk through the woods, we have our binoculars with us, but I don't go to great effort to try to find stuff simply because it's so difficult to find many of those species and the vegetation, it's not worth taking the time. But it's just as gratifying now, from my perspective, to be able to hear them. In fact, maybe more so because you go, oh, there's a red-eyed vireo, oh, there's an eastern wood peewee, and so on, just by picking it up. And to the extent that Merlin is helping to connect people to birds and to in a larger sense to nature, it's a fantastic tool, and I would recommend it for everyone. I actually have friends that I didn't realize had some casual interest in birding, and they said, hey, I'm using this thing called Merlin, and it's just unbelievable. I had no idea we have all these birds in our yard. And so Merlin has opened up an entirely new world for them. So hats off to the geniuses at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology for developing this tool that's really advancing bird conservation in a substantial way and bringing many more people into the fold in terms of being aware of birds, appreciating birds, and then wanting to advocate for them. Because we really need to have that happen.
And by the way, for our listeners, in case they wanted to download it onto their phone, it's free.
It is free.
And it's easy. It's got a low footprint to download to your phone, so it's not very intrusive to your phone. So I like using it. It's I feel sometimes I'm cheating, but you know, I've noticed that, Craig, when I'm out with you know, what I call expert birders, they often a lot of times they don't look at the bird. They listen, they say okay, and they're perfectly happy with hearing the bird. And the times where they do look up and they point is for us novices who want to see the bird. Otherwise, for them, they're just fine as can be as just hearing the bird. They don't actually need to see it, which I think is kind of interesting.
Yeah, you know, there are a couple of modes that birders are in typically. One is when you're out with a group and you want to see things. That's when you really put a lot of effort into trying to find it visually so people can lock onto it and see what's actually singing. But if you're in the business of doing conservation or research, whatever the case may be, simply hearing the bird is enough to document its presence. And so you go with that. You don't spend a lot of time looking for them because you just don't have the time to do it. And you kind of know what they look like. It's like, oh, I know what that looks like. They're
if
really
it's something
cool.
I haven't seen before, but I'm hearing it, I will take the time.
Yeah,
of course.
So when people are going out and buying bird houses and bird seed, bird feed, are there types of bird houses for nesting and such for when the birds come through that they should or should not buy?
I think so. I always try to, because I'm not a, I don't have a lot of bird boxes out on my house or my whatever, but I always try to point people to an organization called Wild Farm Alliance. They have a lot of resources available for nest boxes because nest boxes are really, it's not a one-size-fits-all kind of deal. So like you're not going to build the same nest box for a bluebird that you're going to build for maybe say like a screech owl or a wood duck. So they have a lot of different resources, not just on how to build them, but like what height to have them at and what direction you should be facing the entrance and all that kind of information. It's a really great, and I think they're based in, I know they have staff in Wisconsin, but it's a really great organization. I think that's the easiest thing I usually point people to for nest box resources.
So if you're going to put up a nest box, it would be good to be at least cognizant of what that nest box is good for or what maybe the kind of species of bird you want to see.
Yes, because they can also be designed even like, they gets really into the specifics, but when you can design them so that the hole that the bird is coming through can fit that bird, but maybe not certain predators or how to design it to prevent, you know, maybe brown-headed cowbirds from coming in and nest parasitizing, depending on what bird you're working on. There's a lot of details.
Yeah. Another question is for bird feed, What is the bird feed that you folks recommend in for general populations of birds?
I mean, I usually buy, and this is just, I don't know if it's the official recommendation anywhere, but I usually just go with black oil sunflower seed because it's the most bird species are going to like it. You can also get thistle at times because that's what a lot of the finches and everything really go after, but then if you really want to bring in things like robins and, you know, insects, you can have little grubs and worms, but that's really getting into, but.
So Craig, we've got 3 minutes left, and what do you think are the greatest, what's the greatest threat to our bird populations in the Driftless?
Well, so if we put it in, if we pull the camera back and take a big picture look, Frank, that the number one driver of bird declines, and as Kristen pointed out, they are significant and ongoing, and we really need to address it in a serious way, is habitat loss. And so to the extent that people can rewild their yards, take some of what is lawn and turn it into habitat for birds and pollinators and such, that begins to address the habitat loss issue. The other two big drivers of bird declines are window collisions, which kill perhaps a billion birds a year. And everybody that has a house, I would wager, is hearing that unfortunate thump at times when a bird hits the window and dies. There are very effective treatments that you can put on your windows that will significantly diminish bird collisions and still not really impair your ability to enjoy looking out the window. That's another consideration. And then finally, cats. And, you know, outdoor cats, and I think cats are wonderful animals, but outdoor cats are a significant problem because they kill an awful lot of birds needlessly. And so to the extent that people can be mindful of that and keep their cats either indoors or on leash or in a catio, even better, that allows it to be outside and enjoy being outside but not running around and killing birds and other wildlife would be really helpful. And if those three things were addressed, then I think we have a good shot at turning this bird decline problem around.
Mm. Kristen, we got 1 minute left.
Yeah.
What's the Audubon Society doing for this, and how can we help?
Yeah, so I mean, the Audubon Society has programs all across the United States that are looking at these kinds of habitat loss. I mean, the conservation ranching program that I'm a part of is really trying to get people to look at their property and their landscape from the bird's eye view. So there's a lot of people out there who are doing a lot of habitat restoration and work, but they tend to key in on maybe one habitat like grassland or maybe an interior forest. But we here in the Driftless have such a diversity of these landscapes because of our topography and how everything shifts around here, that getting landowners to look at the whole perspective of their property and how it fits into the landscape, and also look at the gradients of the habitat going through it. So if they have like a ridgetop grassland that goes down into the forest, then do they also have that interior, like that intermediate shrub area to protect like the Bell's Vireos and other things? We have a tendency to have lost a lot of those transitional habitats. So for me, I work a lot with landowners to try to get them to see all parts of their land and how each type of their habitat is just as important.
So the transitional habitats, yes, are just as important.
They are. They absolutely are. We lost bobwhite in this area because we don't have transitional habitats. Ruffed grouse is that early successional, is a type of transitional habitat.
People tend to think black and white.
Yeah.
I have this type of habitat or I have that.
Exactly.
But the transitional zone in between is
very important. Very important.
Fascinating. Yes. Thank you for that. And so there you have it. For our listeners, you have spent another hour with us here at WDRT 91.9 FM in Viroqua. Frank Dravis, we're talking about birding, spring birding, and my guests have been Kristen Zumo from the Audubon Society and Craig Thompson, co-founder of Driftless Birds. So thank you for joining us today.